Let's stay with the theme of disintegrating marriages. To tie the knot, you need a man and a woman to decide they want to get married. And for a divorce, you need one of the married parties to say, it's over, I want out. But in a recent Queensland case of McKenzie and McKenzie, a divorce was granted, but neither the husband nor the wife had filed a divorce application with the family court. This is not unique. There are indeed an increasing number of cases where a guardian, appointed to look after the affairs of a loved one, has gone to court to seek a divorce for a family member. Brian Hurd is a partner with Brisbane law firm Carne Reedy Hurd.
Damien, it was extraordinary. These two parties, Mrs. McKenzie and Mr. McKenzie, married in 2003 and they separated in 2011 when the husband literally disappeared and could never be found again. Just after that, the wife asked her mother in October 2011 to help her prepare an application for a divorce for her. She had some issues with her mental capacity, so her mother was inveigled to try and assist her to do that. Before she got around to actually filing an application for divorce, she had a significant medical event and ended up with a hypoxic brain injury, and as a result, became effectively incapable of managing her affairs. So the mother then applied and was appointed by the Queensland Civil Administrative Tribunal, along with the wife's sister and brother, to be what's called the administrator for the daughter. That is, a person to make financial and legal decisions for the daughter. Shortly after that, the mother then applied to the family court for the court to grant a divorce for her daughter in her capacity as the administrator for her daughter. So the mother had to argue that. And of course, what she argued was when the daughter did have some capacity, she had approached the mother to help her prepare a divorce. So that was evidence, of course, of her intention to divorce, which was subsequently superseded by that medical event.
And what did the court decide?
It granted the divorce. It was a very short decision, very cryptic, but basically decided that the mother had satisfied the criteria for a divorce for her daughter, namely that they had been separated for 12 months and that the daughter had evinced previously an intention to want to be divorced. So because those two characteristics were satisfied, then the divorce should be granted. It didn't seem to be an issue at all that the mother was the applicant really, not the daughter. So the reality now is that people we appoint as substitute decision makers or even appointed by tribunals can actually make these sorts of applications on our behalf.
And I take it the husband is still out of the picture. He never came back?
No, he has remained disappeared and has never resurfaced to come forward and say anything about it.
Really interesting. I understand that this case builds on a similar case, a somewhat similar case from New South Wales a few years ago, Price and Underwood. And there were actually substantial assets involved, weren't there?
There were substantial assets involved. And again, as is common in cases like this, not so much in McKenzie and McKenzie, but certainly in other cases like Price and Underwood, this was a blended or what we call a mixed master family situation. Mr. Underwood married Mrs. Price in late 1980s. It was for both of them their second marriage, and Mr. Underwood had two children from his first marriage, and Mr. Underwood and Mrs. Price actually had two children of their own after they got married. Subsequently, Mr. Underwood applied for a divorce on the 12th of July 2007, so many years later. Initially, that was granted on the 9th of April, but then subsequently it was appealed against by the wife, and the court accepted her appeal and set aside the divorce. That was on the 15th of April. On the 16th of April, the next day, the daughter from the first marriage, who had been appointed by Mr. Underwood as his enduring power of attorney, made another application to the family court for her father to be divorced from effectively her stepmother. And by this time, Mr. Underwood was in hospital. He was unconscious, and apparently, according to the doctors, had only 3 days to live. So the daughter at this stage made the application knowing all that and in her capacity as the enduring power of attorney for her father, Mr. Underwood.
And again, she was arguing he had, prior to his loss of capacity, expressed a desire to get a divorce and he had set that train in motion.
He had done two things. He had actually applied previously himself for a divorce, which was set aside on appeal. So that was the first piece of evidence, that he wanted a divorce. The second piece of evidence, which the courts look for, is things he may have said or done while he did have his capacity about what his intentions were. And I think, as I recall it, one of the most riveting statements or evidence given in the proceedings was evidence that he had said to somebody, I can't recall who, that he, quote, just wanted to die single. That piece of evidence was a very powerful piece of evidence to again indicate what his intentions were so far as divorcing was concerned before he's lost his capacity. And as it turned out, he did die single.
Why was his application to get divorce appealed and why was that initially successful?
It was initially successful only because there was some doubt about the actual date of separation. So in terms of the first divorce application, he asserted it was a particular date. The wife said, no, it wasn't. It was a later date. The wife's later date was within 12 months. In other words, the 12 months had not expired in order to satisfy that major criteria for a divorce. Of course, the court found, ultimately, that the daughter could bring the application for divorce on her father's behalf. Not only could she, the court actually abridged the time for the granting of divorce. In other words, normally when you apply for a divorce, it's initially granted, but it doesn't take effect for another month. On this occasion, in Price and Underwood, given Mr. Underwood's circumstances, the court actually granted an abridgment of that time and actually gave effect to the divorce, as it said, on the rising of the court. In other words, the same day.
Was that breaking new ground?
It's been done before, as I understand, but in these circumstances was very significant because he died the very next day.
And having
been divorced the day before, that meant, of course, he died without a spouse. And he also apparently had never done a will. So he would have died if he was still married with a spouse, with the laws of intestacy that would have applied. And his second wife would have benefited from those. But having died the next day, divorced without a spouse, the second spouse, that is, dipped out, as they say, when it comes to her position as a spouse under the laws of intestacy.
Are these cases often really just fights between the child of the first marriage, who has enduring power of attorney, and the second spouse? And are they really, is this just a proxy war where really they're fighting over the assets?
That's right. I call it a collision between love and longevity. In other words, the relationship between people used to be regarded generally as a decision they made themselves, between themselves. But because of increasing longevity, increasing propensity to lose our capacity, and because of these complex family fandangos we have, you know, the blended mixed master families, the increasing wealth and the propensity for people to lose their capacity because they're living longer, suddenly you've got decision makers, these privatised decision makers, enduring attorneys, etc., being brought into the whole mix of the relationship between the parties and being able and empowered to actually make decisions about their parents' relationships. And that itself is not so much a new development, but it's a real extension of what we conventionally thought enduring attorneys could do, for example. So now they can manipulate, re-engineer, reverse engineer their parents' lives where their parents have lost capacity. And it appears as though both the law and the courts are supporting this sort of extensive ambit when it comes to the powers of the enduring power of attorney and other substitute decision makers. It's a fascinating subject.
Brian Hurd, is there a way of people preparing for this eventuality and making sure that these sorts of disputes don't happen or don't happen often?
It's very, very difficult. The law is a blunt instrument in many ways, and it's very difficult to do anything in a legal context that can prevent these sorts of things happening. Sometimes it can be fair to say that it's a good thing that these things can happen. Certainly in Mackenzie and Mackenzie, there was no reason, it would appear, why that marriage sort of subsisted. So there would be a good reason for mother in that particular case to make the application to have her daughter divorced. In other cases, of course, you can imagine that there are all sorts of perhaps implications in terms of children's motives when it comes to using these powers to re-engineer their parents' affairs. Financial motives, on the basis that really what they're doing is doing a bit of peremptory estate planning. In other words, using family law proceedings to protect the children's estate interests when it comes to the estates of their respective parents. Now, that can't be ignored. The reality is that will always be potentially a motive, but in terms of preventing or controlling or at least restricting your substitute decision makers to use these powers inappropriately, it all comes back in many ways to the appointment of people. In other words, when parents are called upon to appoint an enduring power of attorney, especially in blended family situations, who should they appoint? Because the logical thing to do is to say, well, I'll balance the ledger, as it were, and I'll appoint a child from the first marriage and I'll appoint my second spouse together so they can make joint decisions. That's a very effective technique because, generally speaking, it requires two people to make any decisions for the mother or father who've lost capacity. But secondly, it's highly unlikely, of course, that the decisions that they make will be in either of their interests. In other words, they are forced to be more objective in terms of what they do or not do, where both have to make the decision together. So I say it comes back to these issues of who you appoint. Secondly, other things you can do in enduring powers of attorney, which is an unexplored area, even for lawyers, is you can insert terms and conditions in an enduring power of attorney. And I've actually seen examples where, in a second marriage, the father has requested the insertion of a clause in the enduring power of attorney which requires his attorney, which was a son from his first marriage, to ensure that his second spouse, his wife, was provided with a place to live in for the rest of her life if she wished, if the father ever lost his capacity. So what he was doing then was using the enduring power of attorney to ensure, by these conditions that he inserted, that the interests of his spouse were protected against what the attorney might be tempted to do, of course, once Dad lost his marbles.
Brian Hurd, partner with Brisbane law firm Khan Reedy Hurd.